I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 13th of May. In Compton, California, without citizens' knowledge, surveillance technology is at work. Wide area surveillance from the air. The FBI is rolling out a sprawling data complex that contains over 147 million mugshots and sets of fingerprints. They're housed in storage facilities the size of 2 football fields. This hour, an inside look at these emerging technologies. They could revolutionize policing, but could also be a substantial intrusion by government. We have two guests with us this hour of the program. G.W. Schultz is an investigative reporter who focuses on homeland security for the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's done stories for NPR, Wired, The Daily Beast, The San Francisco Chronicle, The Houston Chronicle, Mother Jones, and much more. He also wrote for the San Francisco Bay Guardian. Also joining us is Amanda Pike, producer of The iFiles, an investigative news YouTube channel that is curated by the Center for Investigative Reporting. She has spent a number of years producing documentaries for PBS, CBS, ABC, National Geographic, A&E, Lifetime, and The Learning Channel. And this series that they have done looks into this issue of privacy versus safety and covers all kinds of these new technologies. It also is the basis of a documentary on KQED. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and here's how you can reach us this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. GW, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. And Amanda, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, this technology is quite something, and you can only imagine that probably a year from now, right after you've done this report, things will be advanced even further. Let's start in Compton, California. Interesting background story of why they have this surveillance technology from the air and why nobody was told about it. What is this surveillance? What kind of surveillance are we seeing there? GW?
So in early 2012, an Ohio-based company approached the Sheriff's Department in Compton and asked if they wanted to do a short-term test of a technology called wide-area surveillance. And in this case, the way it works is a small plane with a surveillance payload attached to it hovers above the city or circles the city and gathers video of a large geographical area. And then when a crime is reported, the Sheriff's Department, during this test phase, could contact the company and say, hey, can you zoom in the footage you've collected on this area where the crime was reported and see if you can attempt to piece together what happened, see if there were cars or individuals in the area, and perhaps figure out where they've been leading up to the crime and where they went to after the alleged crime.
Mm-hmm. Amanda, I was amazed that they even admitted we didn't tell people about this because we thought maybe they'd be concerned about Big Brother.
Yeah, we were surprised at that as well, to be honest with you. We went to Compton and were completely open about that we were interested in finding out more about this test of wide area surveillance there. And we had already been to Dayton to Persistent Surveillance, where the company is based. And so we were very surprised that no one in Compton up until this is 2 years later, had known about the test and that there had been nothing written about it before that time. So that was surprising to us as well when that came out.
And I guess at this point, although you have to imagine that pretty soon you're going to be able to see even more, they made a point of saying we can't yet see into people's bedrooms.
Yes. The technology is progressing. But Ross McNutt, who is the president of Persistent Surveillance, he says that his goal with his company is not to increase resolution so that you can, you know, identify a person on the street. As of now, if you watch the report, you can see what this looks like. A person is just a pixel; it's just a dot, and it's impossible to identify people. You can't even identify cars, but you can follow them and watch them until they, you know, stop at someone's house, or you can link to ground-based cameras to zoom in and identify people. So, but he says that his goal is not to be able to zoom down and watch people and identify people from the plane, He wants to, as the technology improves, increase the area covered. So right now, the plane can cover a 25-square-mile area.
Wow.
A few years down the line, he would like to be able to cover a 64-square-mile area. But, you know, Ross is he's a very smart guy, and he is highly aware of the privacy concerns that his technology raises. So I think this is, you know, he does not want to get into a situation where his technology can zoom down to identify people or license plates.
Mm-hmm.
He would like it to remain a little more anonymous that way, although still be able to tap into other existing technology to identify people.
GW, have they been able to catch any criminals as a result of this?
During the experiment with Compton, it was a little more difficult than that. They weren't able to meticulously piece together a series of homicides, for instance. But I think the law enforcement community is intrigued with technologies like this because they're going to give you insights into crimes and criminal patterns that you may not otherwise have. If you're dealing with communities that don't communicate well with the police when it comes to being witnesses in crimes, or if there just weren't that many good witnesses to begin with, this technology has the potential to give you a vantage point on a crime that you may not otherwise have had. So Amanda talked about the inability of this technology to zoom in on people's faces and license plates, but that may not matter if you can observe a criminal activity from overhead and determine where vehicles associated with that activity have been and where they're going. So, for instance, if moments after a crime occurred, you're able to track a car to a gas station up the road, then you can request from that gas station's owner or manager street-level surveillance footage and credit card receipts or debit card receipts or something like that to start to piece together more about that crime that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to. You wouldn't have had the leads necessary to give you that kind of information. So from the perspective of the law enforcement community, if you're an investigator, that's a pretty compelling
right.
opportunity, a compelling defense of the technology that because otherwise you may not have those sorts of insights.
Amanda, is Compton the only community that has this now, or are there others?
Well, Compton isn't using it right now. This was just a test over a two-week period in early 2012. So persistent surveillance has also been tested. Wide area surveillance has also been tested over Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Dayton.
Mm.
But as we say in the documentary State of Surveillance, no police department has officially signed on yet. I think it's mostly, I think, a privacy issue that people are worried about the reaction. You know, after our documentary came out, there was quite a reaction in Compton from people who were surprised that all of this had been going on, and that, you know, because the period that the plane is up in the air for 6 to 8 hours, and they have a record of basically every single thing that happens on the ground during that time in the entire city. So that's, you know, stored until someone gets rid of it, and you can, you know, zoom back and zoom down and look at any during that time and see what happened. So that was a little shocking to people to find out. But in other places, I think it's been a little more above board.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just going to say to what George said in terms of you had asked about solving crimes. So in Compton, we go through the case of a necklace snatching where the assailant was not identified, but they did get more insight into the crime. Something that we were not able to get into in the piece was persistent surveillance or wide area surveillance has also been used in places like Juarez, Mexico, where they had pretty amazing results. I mean, it's already an incredibly high crime rate there as it is, but they you can see actual assassinations taking place. I mean, albeit a long way away, and actually following the assailants back to their house, as George said, seeing where all the cars went after the crime, hooking through to Google Earth and getting a snapshot of the address of the, you know, crime syndicate headquarters. So they've had pretty amazing results.
Mm-hmm.
In some places. It's just a question of our police departments in the United States going to be on board with this technology?
Yeah. Well, GW, considering the fact that there are substantial privacy issues, could all of this particular kind of technology be a no-go on based on constitutional grounds?
Well, that's a really important question, and so many of the issues around that are still up in the air as far as the courts are concerned. I mean, as of now, without launching into a tortured legal debate, basically the view of proponents of these types of technologies is that we don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy when it comes to things like public roadways and public sidewalks. Inside our homes, obviously, it's a lot different when it comes to the warrant requirements for police. But digital technologies are turning a lot of these debates on their head, and they're doing so very, very quickly. And the courts haven't always had time to keep up. So one of the reasons we're so interested in stories like this at CIR is because they're part of a larger debate in the 21st century about powerful public safety tools that have never been available to police before. So what the public's going to have to do is determine where public safety ends and privacy encroachment begins and what the balance is. With a lot of these technologies, there isn't as rigorous of a public debate as a lot of people would prefer before the technologies are widely deployed.
Mm-hmm.
So what we sought to do is identify technologies that could be quickly coming around the corner rather than reporting on them after dozens of police departments in the United States have embraced them.
Right.
And from there, determining what restrictions might be placed on police as far as preserving data generated from new technologies, how rich the data is, how personally identifiable it is. And this technology was really compelling because there are others similar to it, like license plate scanners that have generated a significant amount of debate that to us suggested, well, this is just the next step. There's going to be an allure to this technology for police who, at the end of the day, want to solve crimes. And likely there needs to be a public discussion had first before the technologies are fully embraced. But mm-hmm. wide-area surveillance, as the technology is only going to get more sophisticated, there likely will be more competitors to Ross McNutt's firm down the road. I could be wrong about that. But this technology has been used so much in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we've seen a lot of technologies come back stateside for police purposes that I can't imagine in 5 years there wouldn't be at least continued higher interest in these types of tools.
Yeah. Let's move to the FBI. You write, rolling out a sprawling data complex that contains over 147 million mugshots and sets of fingerprints, many of which belong to people who are not criminals. What is this facial recognition, and why are they storing these millions of mugshots in, I believe it's West Virginia? Amanda?
Well, previously, this has been where all of this is a facility where all of the fingerprints have been stored in the United States once they were all digitized.
Mm.
So every time you get pulled over and a police officer, you know, checks, you know, is checking your identity, seeing if there are any warrants out and that kind of thing, the information is going to this facility in West Virginia. So the mugshot thing is sort of the next step. It's part of this new program called Next Generation Identification. And that is, fingerprints are something that's called a biometric identification, which is just sort of a fancy way of saying, you know, a body part identification. So the problem is that the FBI has found that while fingerprints have been very helpful, they don't always have fingerprints to work with. So sometimes they just have partial palm prints, or sometimes they have a photo. So they were trying to take this database to the next level so that they could utilize this evidence that they were already getting. So that was the thinking behind it, and it's been a slow rollout over a few years of adding more and more things to the database, palm prints, all 10 fingerprints instead of, you know, just an index finger, and the latest thing are mugshots using facial recognition. So they're really trying to build up that database to be on par with their fingerprints so that when they have photos or video stills and things like that, they can use it in the same way that fingerprints have been used in the past to identify.
Mm-hmm. But it's somehow the mugshots and the fingerprints of people who have never done anything wrong are mixed in with people who have criminal backgrounds. Is that right?
Well, yeah, the fingerprint database is not just people who have been fingerprinted because of crimes, but also there's a civil database as well for teachers or anyone who has to register their fingerprints in positions of the public trust. So that's one program, and they have a special system where if you're a teacher and you're going to a new school, or you're starting your profession, they'll check back and make sure that set of fingerprints hasn't been tagged in any other crimes. Now, the mugshots, the FBI say that they only – so mugshots are taken at the time of arrest. So perhaps you won't go on to be charged with a crime. You might not be, let alone be convicted of a crime. But it's unclear to us. It seems as though those mugshots may still stay in the system. It's up to the individual police departments to take those mugshots out of the system if they find that someone is not convicted of a crime. But it seems that is unlikely to happen in all cases. So some of the privacy advocates we talked to were concerned that anyone in the future could end up in that database. There's no as they pointed out, there's no law saying that the FBI is just keeping its facial recognition database to mugshots taken at the time of arrest. They could very well in the future, if they decided to, although they say they have no plans to, include DMV records, for instance. Some local police departments do use facial recognition in regards to DMV photos. They say they have no plans to, but privacy advocates are worried that database could become vastly expanded in the future.
How accurate is facial recognition? It would seem to me as though we all look a lot like a few other people, don't
That's
we?
That's a good question. Well, yes, and I was not. It seems to me that facial recognition is still in its infancy. The statistic that we were quoted was that you put your, they call it the probe image, you put your image in the computer, and they say that, what is it, George, 80% of the time your suspect will appear in the top 50 hits.
Hmm.
So in the 50 people who come back, your suspect will be among them, among 50 people, 80% of the time.
Hmm.
So that's a lot of room for error, that, 20% of the time. Your suspect won't be there. There will only be people who did not commit this crime. And so, again, there's quite a margin for error there. Privacy advocates worry that this is going to be a situation where people are forced to prove their innocence rather than having the government prove their guilt, which is obviously not how things were intended to work. The FBI says that, this isn't a definitive tool, it's an investigative tool. So it's just to help them narrow down their set of suspects, and it's just one more tool in finding the suspects rather than a definitive marker like a fingerprint, for instance.
We're going to go to phone calls and emails that are coming in, and here's how you reach us if you would like to. 800-486-8655. The state of surveillance this hour of the program with investigative reporters Amanda Pike and G.W. Schultz. They are with the Center for Investigative Reporting, and they've written a lot about this issue and also done a documentary on the state of surveillance. Wide area surveillance, the FBI rolling out this huge new complex this summer that will have mugshots of people and fingerprints. We have yet to talk about other surveillance, and there are some communities that are pretty upset and have put a stop to some of this kind of surveillance. I believe Oakland is one of them. What do you think about all of this? Does it make you feel more secure? Because obviously in the hands of diligent police officers, you might be able to track crimes faster and more accurately. Could it also, though, trample on your privacy rights? Does that concern you at all? Here's our phone number. Join us, 800-486-8655. We'll be with you in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for our guests, starting with John in Milwaukee. Hey, John.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, is that me? I'm on the air.
You're on the air, John.
Oh, yeah. I just like, it's Orwellian, the stuff that they're doing, the government. And it should be unconstitutional, and everybody should be up in arms and shut them down. And like George Carlin said, don't believe anything the government tells you.
And what do
and
you
don't believe anything the government tells you, you don't let them have the powers that they've taken.
What do you worry about when it comes to privacy? What are your concerns, John?
The whole scheme of mind control of government and media domination of the people. They're creating chaos in order to create a dictatorship, a total mind control, like 1984.
GW.
You know, this is always going to be a complicated debate. We've been covering this stuff for years at CIR, and a lot of people we talk to in the law enforcement community, they don't wake up each day and set out to violate the civil liberties or privacy of everyday Americans. But a lot of the tools that are alluring to them are intrusive and do upset the balance the framers of the Constitution set out to establish to keep government from overreaching. And so with each one of these technologies, the public has to ask itself, when do I want police to have these tools available because a crime has occurred that involves my family or someone I care about? But what should also be the restrictions placed on those technologies so that lots of innocent Americans don't get swept up in a dragnet or swept up in an investigative tool when they had nothing to do with the crime that occurred? And that with some of the technologies we've written about, there have been very inconsistent standards in community after community for how police can use the tool, how long they can store data generated from it. I mean, with a lot of these technologies, Congress doesn't really have a role to play because it's up to the local community to decide what those restrictions are. And as long as the public's not aware of the technologies being used in the first place, there's not much of a debate that can occur at City Hall about those restrictions. So that's as far as us being a news organization, as far as that goes, we are just setting out to highlight the fact that these tools are being experimented with and implemented. And from there, it's up to local leaders, the people who put them in office, to decide what the rules are going to be.
Do you think this certainly has come forward when we've talked about NSA surveillance? Do you think that there just isn't as much concern about this issue, and thus we've seen a lot of technologies moving ahead because of the fact that we're living in a post 9/11 world?
You know, we're dealing with a lot of intangibles here, where it's hard for people to experience physically what data the government collects about them. If you're not aware of it being stored remotely on a server somewhere and you didn't even know the government collected in the first place, among the many things Americans have to worry about each day, it might not be something that worries them very much. But I think the story has been important to a lot of Americans, and there's been a lot of tension played to the NSA story on down to local surveillance technologies because it raises fundamental philosophical questions about the American experience, mm-hmm. our relationship with the government,
right.
how we identify ourselves, and how we export democratic values to the rest of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, John. Sean in Appleton. Hi, Sean.
Yes, I just really didn't have a whole lot of concern as far as the mugshot and basic information that somebody could just acquire. I mean, that really shouldn't be an issue for someone who didn't commit a crime because chances of you not having an alibi for where you are when you weren't the one that committed the crime seem to be pretty slim.
Amanda.
I couldn't hear you that well. You were saying that if you haven't committed a crime, you don't really have anything to worry about?
Yes.
Some people certainly do feel that way. I guess the what we've been interested in exploring at CIR is where that line is between safer streets and something that verges more on spying. And so that's really where we've been looking. And I think it depends on how this technology is deployed. I agree, you know, fingerprints, are fingerprints a bad idea? Mugshots doesn't seem like a bad idea. But then the question becomes, how far is this going to go if and when our DMV photos are in the system? Do I have to worry that I have never committed, I've never been arrested for any crime, but do I have to worry about my photo coming up with convicted killers?
Right.
And, you know, maybe that's not the one they flag and maybe it isn't. You know, facial recognition is in its infancy. If you're one of those 50 hits and they're assuming 80% of the time the right person is there, well then, you know, depending on how this technology is deployed, your face could end up being there when you haven't done anything wrong. And so I think that's what people are concerned about.
Thank you, Sean, for the call. An email from Paul. The collected data can also be combined with other data collection, cell phone, Wi-Fi, surveillance cameras, to identify and track individuals and vehicles. Every person and vehicle visible is being tracked. There's also work to extrapolate tracking where individuals and vehicles are obscured. The fact that government officials are actively attempting to conceal such abilities and surveillance activity is what I find disturbing. GW, we'll give that one to you.
Yeah, what we saw in Compton was a lot of folks frustrated with the transparency issue and the extent to which government informs the public that certain types of programs or technologies are being experimented with or used. Sometimes the issue of transparency is just too wonky for a lot of Americans, and it doesn't really matter that much to them how much they know about a certain technology being used or a test around a certain technology. But in the wake of our reporting in Compton and public debates down there about it, it was clear that a lot of people did care about the transparency issue and were frustrated that they were only learning later that the technologies were being utilized. So, mm-hmm. I mean, all the way up to the NSA from the ground level to local law enforcement level, transparency and what the government tells the public about what it's doing is going to continue to be an issue. It could be that certain types of data collected or utilized aren't that really big of a deal and don't affect a lot of Americans. But what we've seen with the NSA story, for instance, is a lot of frustration from the public about what they weren't being told or what intelligence officials were telling Congress about certain programs.
Amanda, what was the city that's in the documentary? Was it Oakland, where there was a great deal of concern about this and they stopped? I can't remember what kind of surveillance was taking place.
Yes, exactly. It was in Oakland, near here. This was around the Domain Awareness Center, and that was exactly the issue there. It wasn't any one particular type of technology. The idea there was that they were going to network and centralize everything in one place. So It was exactly that sort of thing. It was a whole network of cameras, and initially there was this plan to link in not only public cameras and red light cameras and that kind of thing, but also private security cameras, maybe even cameras in public schools and that kind of thing. There were, you know, many different levels of the plan, and have that all of that information come into one place: red light cameras, shot spotters, license plate readers, and that kind of thing. And suddenly, you're looking at an enormous amount of data that is all networked together that can give you a detailed picture of people's lives as they move through society, or at least that's what people were concerned about. Some privacy advocates here were very concerned about it and were very vocal, and the city council decided to table that aspect of the Domain Awareness Center for the time being. So it'll be interesting to see, because people wanted more information and they didn't feel confident that that the plans had really been thought through and that the proper safeguards were in place. So mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see if that comes back online and where that goes in the future.
Ruth in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I just feel like this takes our policing and security in a totally wrong direction. I think there's lots of ways that this particular data collection can be misconstrued, or innocent people can be brought forward because you happen to be driving by and you're seen as a suspect. But more than that, it's like money needs to be going into, you know, proven things like community policing. And after 9/11, when we established Homeland Security, I expected to see a lot more community policing, and I knew personally our local police chief, and he was very supportive. He really was expecting more with community policing, too, and just the opposite happened. Their budgets got cut. Instead of that money going into local law enforcement and fire departments, it went into typical military, and so we're just going with this sort of thing in the wrong direction for building healthy communities.
Thanks, Ruth, for the call. GW.
Yeah, that's a totally interesting question that has come up so much since the moment 9/11 occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Huge swells of money were being made available to local police departments from Congress for Homeland Security purposes, and a lot of experts were talking about the risk of losing values like community-oriented policing, which were huge in law enforcement, and particularly in the 1980s and 1990s. So with a wash of money like that available and it being focused on Homeland Security, a lot of people were making the argument that we had become distracted from traditional policing techniques, traditional law enforcement techniques. Police chiefs around the country were saying things like before 9/11, counterterrorism took up very small percentages of my day. After 9/11, William Bratton, the former LAPD police chief, just talked about this. After 9/11, it became a huge part of his workday every day. So what's sacrificed each time a police chief, the leader, the voice of a department and a community on public safety issues, is having to discuss counterterrorism instead of things like homicide solve rates, sexual assault solve rates. That's a balance that has to be made every day. And security experts will also talk a lot about, I mean, you mentioned earlier whether or not certain technologies make Americans feel more secure. That's an extremely difficult thing to measure. But amid that difficulty, it's possible for government to make the mistake of spending endlessly in an attempt to reach 100% security, or the sensation of 100% security, which is unattainable. So public safety can be one of the toughest things to budget around and create rules for, because so often the discussion is how secure do we feel, and it's not something that you can measure very, very easily compared to things like the number of kids you're graduating from high schools every year, or the number of people who suffer from an emerging disease. It's a difficult area of public policy to handle, to manage.
I would imagine, I don't know if there are studies on this, but you would think that if you have a really strong community policing unit and people in a neighborhood know each other and they also know their police officers, that they would be suspicious of people taking each other's necklaces and running down the block, or cars coming down the block and people are getting in them and moving away from a scene of a crime, that nothing really beats that kind of policing. Is that naive in 2014, Amanda?
That's an interesting question. You know, when we were in Compton, part of the problem was that there is, in a city like that, there's a lot of suspicion between residents and police, and many residents don't feel like they can go to those kind of police for that sort of thing, or they worry that if they cooperate with the police that, you know, they're in danger if they live in a high crime area. So that can be a problem. What was interesting, just talking about this sort of I think healthy skepticism of new technology, is that was exactly what one of the police officers that we interviewed for the documentary was saying. He's the commander of the real-time analysis and critical response division with the LAPD, where, you know, it's a very high-tech emergency response center. They have access to 1,000 cameras around the city. But even this commander was saying that he worried about his troops relying too much on technology and sort of falling back on that rather than their training, their own, you know, critical analysis and that kind of thing. So I think even the police officers in the field tend to have, you know, a healthy amount of skepticism about this technology. You know, we wouldn't want to dismiss any of it out of hand if it could, you know, solve crimes and keep us safer.
Right.
But obviously we just want to be careful about what we choose to use, know that it's thoroughly vetted, and know that we're all, you know, on board with the testing that's going on. We're all aware of it, and that we're all, you know, we're all giving it a healthy once over to make sure that it's doing what we hope it will be
right.
doing, and that we're aware of any costs to us in terms of loss of privacy and that sort of thing.
Well, the least they can do is let us know it's happening. That would seem only fair,
yes.
I would think. So all this, in the documentary, there are pictures of officers sitting at what looks like command centers. All of this information from the cameras in the sky and from traffic poles and wherever these cameras are they all being fed to some central location, GW, so you need to staff these people at desks who are looking at what the cameras are seeing?
Yes and no. I mean, a lot of these centers have popped up after 9/11 and become extremely popular inside law enforcement. The idea of centralizing more and more data sources to get to develop a stronger awareness of what's going on in your community. So, yes, anytime you if you build a they've been called variously fusion centers or data analysis centers, and if you build a facility like that, you're going to need to staff it and run it. I mean, as far as having, you know, dozens of officers sitting before banks of terminals, no, most communities can't afford that kind of investment. But that's where video analytics is going to come in down the road, where software tools that search for suspicious activity inside a video feed could potentially alert you to behavior or activity that's suspicious without you having to have someone sitting there watching the monitor at all times. But, you know, that is another body that you have now inside a data analysis center rather than out on the streets shaking hands with business owners and working a traditional beat.
Yeah. Thank you, Ruth, for your call. John in Madison. Hi.
Oh, hi there. Just to kind of get back to earlier caller and their comment that, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, you've got nothing to worry about. I've argued this with family members who are, let's say, on the far right. And, you know, the more I think about this, what we're overlooking is the rule of unintended consequences. Someday somebody will be accused of a crime because of all this data gathering that they had nothing to do with whatsoever. And they're going to have to spend a tremendous amount of resource and or possibly their own freedom to get out from underneath this. And it's just not right. So that's my comment. I'll listen to what your guests have to say.
Thank you very much for the call, John. Amanda, you want to start?
You know, I think it really depends on which technology you're talking about, whose hands it's in, and how it's being used. I mean, it's really, I think, depends specifically. You know, the wide area surveillance, that's been the technology from our documentary that's captured a lot of people's attention because it's so all-encompassing. It's on such an unprecedented scale. It's, you know, citywide surveillance. And when we first heard about it, I had a lot of, you know, reservations about it, and I still do. And we need to think about if this is how we want to police our communities. However, you know, the personal side of me, who's a mom, imagines, well, if God forbid, you know, one of my children were kidnapped, would I care, you know, if anyone's privacy was violated, you know, of having placed up with this guy? Probably not, because it would all, you know, come down to my children or whatever personal crisis is going on. So it's kind of, it's a tough line to walk, because you can understand the arguments of wanting to keep people safe and wanting to protect people, but then you can also imagine that you have to be careful about who has this technology, who's keeping this information, who can look at it, and what's being done with it, because so much information is being generated. So that's why it's so important to keep talking about these things and know who's using them, what they're doing with the information, and make sure that we're all aware of it and we're all on board with whatever privacy or whatever we think that we're willing to give up for the perceived safety that we hope to get from it.
And speaking of kidnappings, an email has come in. Isn't every child encouraged to get fingerprinted due to child abduction concerns, i.e. the Amber Alert? GW?
Yes, but I mean, not every American child is fingerprinted. For sure. I mean, there's a lot of techniques available now for biometric identification, and it's up to parents to decide if they want those sorts of biometrics recorded so that down the road, potentially their child could be located or identified if something happens. So that's like an interesting second track to this entire debate that involves the victim side of this issue. So if your child were to disappear and turn up somewhere and there was no other identification on them, available on them, would there be a biometric data available to help identify them? Because what people often forget about things like DNA is it's not a magic bullet. If you don't have a reference point for it, this is just an example of a biometric. If you don't have a reference point for it, a DNA inside a system already to compare against, then you can't you can't just extract DNA from someone and magically identify them. There has to be a system of data in place to compare against. Same thing with other types of biometrics. So for concerned parents, that could be something that they're very much interested in doing, recording digital fingerprints to their child so that down the road there aren't issues like that, or that it makes it potentially easier to identify them.
Hmm. We welcome more phone calls, and here's how you reach our conversation. We're talking this hour with Amanda Pike and G.W. Schultz, reporters from the Center for Investigative Reporting, and they have done the work for a documentary and written extensively about this surveillance state, all the new technology that we have that's being implemented in some places. Being tested without our knowing about it. Is it overboard? Is it a big brother state? Could it be used to harm us in addition to helping us? At what point is it too much and there are substantial privacy concerns? What do you think? We welcome your calls in the minutes that remain. Our number 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Email that's come in from Kathy, who said, a dear friend and I look so much alike that on occasion her husband and her mother have mistaken me on a quick glance for her. If this could happen to people who know her so intimately, what chance is there that a computer could do the same? Amanda.
Well, that's a very good question. Like I said, you know, facial recognition is in its infancy. 80 or 85% chance of the suspect being among the top 50 hits doesn't feel all that comforting. The FBI explained to us that computers see faces differently than we do. So they don't see gender, they don't see race, they see a multitude of, you know, pinpoints and distances around your face. So I don't know whether a computer would see faces the same way that people do, but certainly, I mean, I think it's a huge concern. And luckily, so far, you know, officers we've spoken to have said that they are using this as a diagnostic tool, as an investigative tool, and not as an identification tool. But we have to keep in mind the limitations of these technologies, certainly.
Mm-hmm. GW, are there other kinds of technology that are in the works that maybe are down the road a little bit more than the ones you write about but intrigue you?
Oh, man, good question. I haven't even thought about that today. I'm really interested in social media analysis and what we can derive from things like Twitter and Facebook. I think the law enforcement community is spending a lot of time thinking about this right now. What can they glean from conversations that criminal suspects have on Facebook? What can it glean from conversations that criminal suspects have on Twitter? Mm. There's such an ocean of public information through these tools now that the allure for police is irresistible. And if you're an investigator, it's another available tool that you didn't have 10, 20 years ago. So I think social media analysis is only going to get smarter and better and look for key words, key language. We saw it in London after a set of riots there where police were using social media to understand what people were saying to one another. But you run into sticky First Amendment issues there because they're communicating publicly perhaps a political point of view or something that doesn't rise to the level of reasonable suspicion, let alone probable cause that you've engaged in a crime. That doesn't mean that social media analysis is going to go away for tomorrow, be any less attractive to police. I think it's just going to get smarter, stronger, and better, just like video surveillance. And the continuing question will be, to what extent can police use that information?
Right. Tom is next in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen. I don't know. I think the younger generation seems less concerned about this overall issue of privacy than my generation, apparently. But, you know, the expectation of privacy isn't just that the government may get it wrong. I mean, it's that I'm entitled to privacy as a human being. I'm entitled to have a veil around me in terms of what I think or what I want to share just with small numbers of people, whether or not I want to be seen or followed on the street. And I would ask the young lady, do you live in a glass house? Do you want to live in a glass house? I doubt it, you know, but we don't know what you're doing in there. These questions are more fundamental to the nature of human endeavor than they are, you know, just about whether or not we can catch a few more crimes, which, by the way, the crime rate has gone down dramatically over the last three decades. So, you know, you gotta wonder why we don't spend a little more time figuring out how we can catch these financial criminals on Wall Street rather than wondering about whether we can watch everybody on the street.
Amanda.
I completely agree with you. I don't mean to seem I have a healthy skepticism about all of these tools. I was just saying that I can understand how they can grip you on a personal level when you imagine, you know, God forbid, things happening to family members and what you would or wouldn't be able to accept at that moment. But certainly, you know, a big problem here is that the law has not kept up with this technology. The technology is far out, you know, outpacing the laws that could not have envisioned the kind of things that are coming around now. You know, one way is there's been a lot of talk about drones. People are very concerned about drones. There's a bill here in California to limit police to not be able to use drones without a warrant. However, they haven't done anything about manned aircraft, so this would not affect wide area surveillance. So, you know, so there hasn't been a lot of thinking through kind of what technology is enabling people to do, and you know, and certainly the law hasn't kept up. I think it's a fallacy to say that people are used to being watched. One of the officers that we interviewed in the documentary says, well, when people hear about wide area surveillance, you know, they might be a little bit upset, but people have been used with all the cameras around, people are used to being watched all the time. And I don't know that that is true. I think that we're only coming to understand how much we're being watched with various revelations that have come out on a federal level and now on a local level. And I think that part of what we're trying to do with our reporting is really understand the ways in which we are being watched, which we might not even be able to realize, so that people can have an input as to what they're willing to sacrifice, if anything, in terms of this privacy.
Thank you very much, Tom, for your great points. Len in Madison, hi.
Yeah, hi. Say, the gentleman who called in four or five calls ago said if you don't have anything to hide, you shouldn't be afraid. I called to vehemently disagree with him, but I'd also like to say the gentleman that injected politics just a couple of calls ago is wrong as well. I don't feel this is a left or a right issue. Anybody that cares about the Constitution should absolutely be appalled at some of the stuff that goes on. For people who say if you don't have anything to hide, you shouldn't be afraid, I want to go to their house with the SWAT team and go through their house searching for child pornography without a search warrant. After all, if they have nothing to hide, what are they afraid of? And for those people who say that as well, I want to know, why isn't your toilet setting out in your front yard? Why do you have your toilet hidden behind a door? Everybody knows when you go into the bathroom what you're doing, but, you know, if you have nothing to hide, why don't you do it out in the front yard?
Len, thank you very much for your call. You graphically made your point. GW.
I mean, this is, you ask any privacy advocate this question, if you have nothing to hide, you should worry. Things that they're going to have a host of answers for you. I mean, one of them that I hear often when I talk to folks in the privacy community is that, well, then why do Americans have blinds over their living room windows, right? There is a measure of privacy that we all expect, and collectively mine might be different than someone else's. So it's difficult for someone else to make the case that I shouldn't have control over the amount of privacy I enjoy or experience because their view is that I have nothing to worry about. You can't construct policy around refrains that are overly simplistic, right? Because my interests as far as public safety and privacy are going to be different than next person's, and that's where public debate occurs. Mm-hmm. I mean, we keep going back to that idea of a public debate needing to occur on these technologies, but that's where it happens. That's where compromises are made and restrictions are put on what police can and can't do. Mm. So if we look at traditional warrants for our homes, the lines are fairly bright for when police can come inside of our homes and conduct searches. And when they can't, they're expected to demonstrate to an impartial judge that there's a probable cause I've committed a crime.
Mm-hmm.
They obtain a warrant from that impartial judge and then enter a home to conduct a search.
GW,
the question now is
very quickly.
When those legal principles are going to be applied to digital information, which is extraordinarily intimate now, more so.
Thank you so much. G.W. Schultz, we're happy to be a part of this debate, and Amanda Pike, investigative reporters, and we thank them. They're with the Center for Investigative Reporting. Interesting hour. Thanks to K.P. Whaley, who's been with us a year today. Yay. Thanks to him for producing the hour and for on-air production.